Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear oral argument from Relator and Appellant in Duncan v. Board of Disciplinary Appeals and in the matter of James M. Duncan.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Schoenberg and Mr. William Kill Garland will present argument for Relator. Relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Please, the court, this is my first opportunity to go before a judge, and he comes after me. I don't know the significance of that, but maybe it's not major. This court is afforded a unique opportunity in the presentation of this case to once again speak for one of the strongest relationships known in our society to protect people. And that's the relationship between a person and his attorney. This is a case, as this court well knows, concerning whether or not the pleading of guilty to a federal act of misprison of a felony is an intentional crime as defined by our disciplinary rules requiring automatic suspension.
You agree that misprison of a felony requires proof that the accused took an affirmative step to conceal the crime?
I believe that misprison of a felony in a lawyer context may require the lawyer to follow a privilege that belongs to a client and not divulge or fail to divulge something that's violative of that statute.
There's nothing in the record that indicates what was being concealed concerned a crime.
That's right, Justice Spector, and that's what's wrong with the case. There's nothing in the record that speaks to what the facts are. Now, you don't need specific testimony from a witness.
Mr. Greenberg, on that point,
yes.
The facts would have been there but for an objection on your part or your...
Absolutely not. That's a frivolous argument. The facts would have been there had the state bar chosen to introduce indictment, the facts that show the conviction, the record of conviction. And that's what Rule 804 says the state bar must do. 804 specifically provides that upon introduction of a certified copy of a judgment of conviction, and that was done, the Board of Disciplinary Appeals shall immediately determine whether the attorney has been convicted of an intentional crime. So there is a mandate in the rule, not like the state bar says in a footnote in Humphrey. As I read the footnote in Humphrey, all you're saying is that's what 804 says. To find if there's a question of intentional crime, then 804 tells you how to do it. Now, what the state bar did in this case is they said, we don't need to do anything. Misprison of a felony is an intentional crime involving moral turpitude, and what we will do is intentionally introduce the plea of guilty, who the person was, and that he's a member of the state bar. That's what they chose to do. They didn't choose to introduce the record of the conviction. Now, they argue in their brief, we made some objections after they rested their case. We made some objections to non-material matters that are proven by documentation. And well, that changes things. Give us a chance to do it differently. I heard an argument here just a minute ago. When there's no evidence of what the facts are, you don't get another chance to go back to the board and say, oh, okay, now we want to present evidence on what the facts are. The bar chose how to present this case.
Can misprison of a felony sometimes be an intentional crime, and other times, depending on the facts in the record in the underlying criminal case, not be an intentional crime?
Justice Gordon, I couldn't agree more.
Well, that was a question,
Sure it can be.
It can be
an intentional crime involving moral turpitude, and it can be not an intentional crime involving moral turpitude. How do we know? We know by the mandate set forth in 804. But the mandate in 804 and the Humphreys case, which cites the Turton case, and the bar says, well, that's new law. That's not new law. Turton's not new law. 804 is the law. They can't say, well, remand this case because we want now to show that what Mr. Duncan did or didn't do that led to the guilty plea in a misprison case is an intentional crime.
Why not?
Mm-hmm. Why not? Because the state bar chose to bring this case as an intentional crime case without that knowledge.
If this court were to say that it's not per se moral turpitude, you don't think they could come back and begin again?
No. I don't think they can come back and begin again unless we're going to give the state bar different rules than we give any other litigant. If this is a civil case, and let me make a comment to Justice Gonzalez on our objection. In any other case, if I ask a question and there's an objection and it's sustained, and you want to bring that up on appeal, best you get a bill of exception and find out what the answer would have been. Well, they didn't do that. If you want to remand the case, best you make a point of error that you want to remand the case. So they didn't do that, Justice Becker, and I think that they like in turn, they chose their theory. They chose the way they wanted to bring the case. And because they did that, and because Ms. Prison can be susceptible to a non-intentional, non-moral turpitude interpretation, that they fail. And when they fail, then the result is rendition. This court has, I hesitate to use the word grapple, but this court has had to concern themselves with lawyer conduct in today's society. And I think that it would be a really strong statement by this court to hold that not only is misprison of a felony not always an intentional crime, but that as it applies to a lawyer, there are certain standards that a lawyer has to follow that are rules he has to obey, but they're not his rules. The lawyer-client relationship and the privilege attached to it, we all know, is not the lawyer's privilege. It's the client's privilege. So unlike what we read in the press, that lawyers are always helping lawyers, this is a stand where the court is helping clients because they're encouraging the free flow of information from the client to the lawyer.
Mr. Greenberg, I'm sorry. It seems, looking at this, at the misprison statute as written, but the overlay that federal cases seem to be giving to the statute, there's a distinction between the failure to provide information and providing misleading information. And going to the lawyer context, and I think your argument is made by the state bar, if the lawyer, this is not a certain, their assertion is that the federal case law overlay over the statute would protect a lawyer who refuses to divulge client information, but perhaps not protect the lawyer who misleads the law enforcement authorities. So I go to the lawyer and I say, lawyer, what do you know about your client's business? The lawyer says, I don't know anything about it. Is different than the lawyer saying, I'm not going to divulge attorney-client privileges. I'm not going to talk to you. And they make the distinction that case law protects the circumstance that you're concerned about because there could not be a conviction but for the lawyer actually going beyond the attorney-client privilege and affirmatively misleading the law enforcement authorities in their investigation.
Well, that's correct, but I have to go back to what are the elements of the misprison offense. And the elements that we're talking about here is that the defendant took an affirmative step to conceal the crime. How did he take an affirmative step to conceal the crime? I think an examination of that bears on whether or not that's moral turpitude. What was he doing? How did he do it? How is that? How do you compare what he did with what his duties are? Now, we're not getting into a where someone comes and tells a lawyer, I'm getting ready to go rob the bank, and the lawyer says, well, I'm good. You want to use my car? We're not getting into a situation where the lawyer is an assistant to the crime. Clearly, if that's true, the lawyer deserves whatever punishment we can give him. But we don't know. That's the answer in this case. We don't know. What is what he did? We don't know.
So it could have been as extreme as intimidation of a witness. Or it could be invocation of the attorney-client relationship.
I certainly think it could have been.
That extreme? Why isn't it part of your burden to show what end of the spectrum this case falls on?
Because it's the state bar that must show that it's a crime involving a moral turpitude. They bring the act. They need to prove it. They didn't prove it. They not only didn't prove it, they intentionally didn't prove it. They did like Turton did. And I know that this court was not unanimous in that opinion. The court was not unanimous in that opinion. But nevertheless, the action of the state bar was clear on what they did. And unless you know, and I'm not asking this court, nor am I suggesting to this court that you should go into extraneous evidence, or the board should go into extraneous evidence. I'm not suggesting that, although that's not a bad idea, and I know Justice Gavitt sometimes thinks that maybe you ought to do that in certain circumstances. But certainly the record of conviction, the facts, which is a part of the conviction, ought to be introduced before the board, so that you can determine as a matter of law, is that moral turpitude or is that not moral turpitude?
And so the board could then determine, I guess, whether the failure, the affirmative step to conceal the crime didn't fall within, say, a crime fraud exception of the attorney-client privilege?
I think so.
And wouldn't they have to more or less retry the...
No.
Retry the case?
Not at all.
Not
at all, Justice Gordon. You would accept the pled to facts as they were presented. You don't. All you're making a determination is that moral turpitude? Like this court had that problem in some of the cases before. Is income tax evasion amoral? But we knew it was income tax evasion. We knew what it was.
Mr. Greenberg.
Yes, Your Honor.
What do you contend the State Bar failed to do in this case?
The State Bar failed to determine the Miss Prison facts as part of the record of conviction to determine whether or not that set of circumstances involved moral turpitude.
How do they go about that?
By introducing the record of conviction as 804 mandates that they do.
The record of conviction mean the indictment and the judgment?
Well, in a federal case, I think there's another document that goes with the indictment and the judgment, which is the plea, facts.
The charging instrument.
Yes.
The indictment or the information.
Yes.
And all that says is, so-and-so, Mr. Duncan is charged with misprision of felony by infracting the statute.
Well, yes, but there is a record in the conviction group of documents.
You meant the colloquy between the judge and the person who pled guilty?
No, sir. I think it's a documented recitation of the facts that is
stipulated.
The stipulations that is part of the record on conviction, which could have easily been introduced. Not testimony, what'd you do, Mr. Duncan? Not retrying anything.
Was there such an instrument in this case?
Not introduced by the State Bar.
And when Mr. Duncan pled guilty to misprision of felony, was there such an instrument?
It's my understanding that there is such an instrument in all federal crimes when you plead guilty.
There wasn't when I was trying cases with the government for 4 years as an assistant United States attorney, but that's another matter.
Okay. I'm not done, thank you.
The court is ready to hear arguments from Emily respond.
May it please the court. My name is Steve Young. I'm the first assistant general counsel at the State Bar. Ms. Acevedo, who usually appears before you on appellate matters, is still out on maternity leave. The principal issue here is misprisonment. And the State Bar takes the position that misprisonment is a crime of moral turpitude per se.
Every time.
Every time. And what does it every time is that in order to prove that conviction, the accused must have taken that affirmative step to conceal the crime. And that affirmative step, he can't take that without some sort of intent.
What's the answer to the argument, however, that sometimes attorneys have to conceal information? They're bound by ethical guidelines to do it, and if they're choosing between one and the other, how can that involve moral turpitude?
I think that's a facetious argument, Your Honor. I think that case law has shown that a mere passive failure to report a felony is insufficient to sustain a conviction. The case that the respondent lawyer or his expert used at the time before the Board of Disciplinary Appeals to prove this up, and I quote from it, it's U.S. versus Hodges, it says, although mere silence is insufficient, the giving of a false statement is a sufficient act of concealment to sustain a prosecution. It doesn't take a great deal.
We don't know here, however, what was said, do we?
No, sir, we don't.
So we don't know. I mean, you have guilt plea. What state law might mandate, your attorney is an oath might mandate regarding your responsibility to your client.
Yes, sir.
Not to divulge confidences, other than the fact that you are compelled to report a crime you know is about to be committed, a future crime.
Yes, sir.
You are bound by your oath, are you not, not to disclose any knowledge that you come to from your client in lawyer-client communication of past behavior?
Yes, sir.
And if federal authorities came to you and inquired, you know, do you have any knowledge? Say, I can't tell you anything about that. You don't know what answer was given. That's lawyer, you know, that's privilege. I can't tell you anything about that. I'm sorry, I can't help you. You don't know what was said.
No, sir, I do not know what was said, but I would...
And it would constitute a federal crime.
Oh, I disagree. I believe you could take the attorney-client privilege and maintain your silence and say, I cannot tell you because I am asserting the attorney-client privilege, and there is no conviction that anybody can point to that anybody...
That's not what the statute says, a federal statute. Federal statute, whoever having knowledge of the actual commission of a felony cognizable by a court of the United States conceals and does not, as soon as possible, make known the same to some judge or other person in civil or military authority under the United States shall be fined not more than $500 or imprisoned for not more than 3 years or both. It doesn't say a damn thing, does it, about your lawyer-client privilege?
The statute itself does not, Your Honor. The case law that has interpreted the statute said that mere silence is insufficient. And that it takes but the giving of a false statement is sufficient.
Mr. Young, let me ask you about that. If I understand Mr. Greenberg's argument, his argument is that unlike the Humphreys case, where you knew his conviction was for tax evasion, here we have a conviction for a violation of a statute which on its face does not rule out mere silence being a basis for a conviction. You have to go to case law for their interpretation of this statute, and case law seems to say that if the lawyer had said, I don't know anything about it, they committed a crime of misprision of felony, but if they say, I'm not going to tell you anything about it, they haven't. Is that a sufficient dichotomy? I mean, critical, your cases, these cases out here that says that a lawyer's claim of his duty is not a violation. But is that a sufficient dichotomy for the purposes of the per se moral turpitude issue, that the lawyer has to use the right, that the lawyer just can't sit there with the agent sitting in his office saying, I don't know anything about it. He really has to say, I'm not going to tell you anything about it. Is that a sufficient dichotomy in case law to say this is not a problem?
It would be the bar's position that it is a sufficient dichotomy. If this court was to disagree, however, we would urge the court to remand this case to the Board of Disciplinary Appeals to look at the underlying facts. There's obviously been some question about what kind of facts you look at. The appellant obviously argues that you should look at only the facts that are part of the criminal record. Many times I submit that you're not going to get any more from the facts that are part of the criminal record than we've got right now with the conviction in evidence.
Mr. Young,
yes,
why should the bar get two bites at this apple? You chose a theory. You pled this case and tried this case as an intentional per se crime. And you're saying, well, if we were wrong, give us another chance.
Well, it's been the policy and the practice of the Board of Disciplinary Appeals not to examine any of the underlying facts, whether it's in the a part of the criminal record or outside of the criminal record. This court has given all of us in the new rule system direction about crimes of moral turpitude, about how we are to proceed. We took the amended footnote in Humphreys to indicate that this court may choose to have the Board of Disciplinary Appeals go into some underlying facts, but there was no direction as to how they were to do that, whether it was just to be looking at some criminal record, whatever that entailed, or whether the Board of Disciplinary Appeals was to somehow now have the ability to conduct some sort of evidentiary hearing. And if this court remands this case to the Board of Disciplinary Appeals, I would respectfully request that you give us some direction as to how the board and how the bar and how the respondent's bar should approach compulsory matters.
I'm wondering what, when a defendant in a criminal case pleads guilty, as Mr. Duncan here, what sort of record the Board of Disciplinary Appeals might look at to make this decision. In Humphreys, we had a full-blown criminal trial and a guilty verdict. And I guess potentially we could have looked at all the trial record in that case. But here, other than the stipulation, the plea of guilty, the charging documents, and what would there possibly be to look at?
I don't think there is anything else. I think that in some cases the indictment will tell you something about the underlying facts. In most cases, I don't believe that it will. The guilty plea does generally does nothing other than tell you what he pled guilty to and what the sentence was. And I think that's what we're seeking direction as to. If we're going to look at these things that people are saying are non per se, and I don't believe this is a non per se offense, but if it is, the court disagrees and says that it is, I'm at a loss, and we need some direction as to what kinds of evidence both the Board of Disciplinary Appeals is entitled to look at and what kind of evidence we should submit to the board.
Does the record here show why the federal judge required Mr. Duncan to make restitution in the amount of in excess of $150,000?
The record doesn't show, and when inquiry was made during the hearing at the Board of Disciplinary Appeals, an objection was made by respondent's counsel and was sustained. There's no indication as to why he made was required to make restitution of over $156,000.
Let me ask a question about your your bright line test. I assume what a lawyer says in the courtroom is still privileged in this statute. We'll just assume it's good. Let's assume you're representing a high-profile client, which there's a lot of press interest in, and you call it a press conference. And the attorney tells the client's side of the story, perhaps, or in answer to questions does, and at some point says, my client is innocent of this crime. When in fact, and recall the communications the attorneys have with the client, he has reason to believe the client is guilty. Is that that would seem to violate this statute, not only as it reads on its face, but as it's been interpreted?
I'm not sure that it would as it's been interpreted. It probably does as it reads on its face.
Well, what if an FBI agent asked the question at the press conference?
That's a little harder question. I'm still not sure that's an affirmative step to conceal the crime. And certainly anything that he says there is, I'm still not sure that's an affirmative, you could classify that as an affirmative step to conceal the crime.
So, but if he says, I don't know anything, when he really means, I don't know anything that I think I can tell you without violating privilege, that might suggest to you the crime.
I don't think so, and I think appellant argued that, but I don't think it will. I think that when you look at the federal law that interprets the statute, it talks about mere silence being insufficient to support a conviction.
This is not silence. They say, what do you know? And he says, I don't know anything. What he really means is, I don't know anything that I can tell you, which perhaps in his mind are the same thing. But because he assumes that that information is absolutely privileged and can't be disclosed. Perhaps he assumes that wrongly.
I think he does assume it wrongly. I think the attorney-client privilege is absolutely sacred. And again, there's been no conviction under the misprison statute for an attorney who's divulged attorney-client privileges. There's one case that I believe is cited in your material out of Arizona where an attorney pled guilty to misprisonment. And the Arizona disciplinary authority ultimately disciplined him, but not because of the misprisonment. They disciplined him because he was convicted of a felony. And when they looked at whether or not he actually committed the misprisonment or whether or not he chose, for expediency's sake, not to contest the matter. So I don't think there's any definitive case law on this.
Let me ask you a question that's somewhat hypothetical and somewhat not. Let's assume that kidnapping and you go across state lines is a federal offense, and you have a lawyer who receives a map to the body of the child, and the lawyer takes the position that that map is obtained because of attorney-client privilege. But the argument is that you have no right to hold that map. You're concealing evidence. Is that a misprison of a felony?
I do not believe so. And you notice that particular individual was not charged with misprison of a felony, even though it was an offense that went across state lines. And certainly given the tenor of things and the aggressiveness of the authorities in going after this piece of evidence that they thought existed, that did in fact exist, and it was in the this attorney's possession. If that had been a weapon that they felt like that they could have used, I feel certain they would have used it, but they did not. I'd lastly point out that as we're still in the infancy of this new grievance system, and we're learning what it is that how it works, how it's being put together, what the Board of Disciplinary Appeals expects from us, what this court expects of the Board of Disciplinary Appeals. We appreciate the input that we've gotten thus far, and quite frankly, we're here seeking additional input and how these things should be tried and presented.
Any other questions? Thank you, Judge.
May it please the court, I'm William Kilgarland. I would like to address Justice Gonzalez's question. It's a statement I'm making outside of the record, but I'm advised by my client that he was required to sign a resume of facts, which is a part of the record of the federal conviction, which was not introduced. And I think had it been introduced, then we probably wouldn't be arguing this case today. Your Honors, this quite simply is a no-evidence case. State Bar says we're looking for your advice. Well, you gave the State Bar advice when you promulgated Rule 8.04. Upon introduction to evidence of a certified copy of the judgment of conviction, so forth, the Board of Disciplinary Appeals should immediately determine whether the attorney has been convicted of an intentional crime. Intentional crime is defined as serious crime. Serious crime is defined as one involving moral turpitude. It was incumbent upon the State Bar to introduce evidence of intentional crime, which they failed to do. That's no evidence. Unless you agree with them that misprisonment of a felony is per se an offense involving moral turpitude. Now let's straighten the law out on what misprisonment felony is. If I elect to remain silent and do not volunteer to produce evidence, then federal case law says that is not misprisonment of a felony. If, however, I am approached by a federal agent and I am a lawyer for an accused and I tell the federal agent I'm not going to tell you that, or I decline to tell you that, or I won't tell you that, that is the offense of misprisonment of a felony. And yet, where is the moral turpitude by having elected to remain silent? You know, Sir Thomas More made this argument some several hundred years ago when charged with treason. And he says, I'm not saying yes or no to the oath. I'm merely remaining silent as to the oath.
Now, where is the moral? Isn't there case law that's contrary to what you just said, though?
I don't believe so.
Isn't there federal case law that says if you just decline to make a statement, that that's not sufficient, that it takes an affirmative misstatement? I don't know. I've not heard anything like that. I don't know where the property is, etc.
Clearly, Your Honor, there is federal case law that says if you do not volunteer, that's not misprisonment. But there is federal case law that says if you decline to answer or say, I don't know. But how are your honors to determine whether that's here or not in this case without the State Bar having offered evidence?
Well, let's get to the hearing. The State Bar tried to find, at the BODA event, didn't the State Bar try to find out some other things that your client objected to?
Your Honor, they rested. If you'll refer to the record, they only did three things, and then they said, we rest. There was no objection at this point. It was only when my client voluntarily took the stand that they attempted to ask questions. But they asked the questions they asked were not on what was contained in the record of conviction and the resume of facts in federal court. They were trying to go outside of that record. Now, I think by Humphreys, you clearly limited consideration to the federal court records and not extraneous matters. But let's assume they did try to do that. Where is the special exceptions that preserves error? Where is the point of error, a cross point of error in this case, that asks for a remand? Just because it's the State Bar of Texas and just because it's a relatively new proceeding here, are we going to abandon the rule that says no evidence, you lose, rendition? Are we going to abandon the rule that says if you want to bring something before consideration of an appellate court, you've got to make a bill of exceptions? Are we going to abandon the rule that says if you want to ask for a remand or something different, you've got to make a point of error? Now, they haven't done any of these things, but they're saying because we're the state bar, please excuse us. We ask for a reversal and rendition. Thank you very much, sir.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the oral argument and the final combined clause. All the foregoing clauses are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The court's oral submission docket for the day is concluded, and we will ask the marshal to adjourn.
Good deal.